Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're examining the true cost of convenience when it comes to when, where, and how we eat.
Dark stores enable workers to eat without any kind of thought to how they're getting their food or how it might have come to be.
DoorDash, Uber, and Lyft in the past have pledged to spend $90 million to try to exempt themselves from the law.
I could be wrong, but I think there's going to be significant regulatory pushback on driverless trucks.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, this is Dana Cowan, and you're listening to Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network. Each week, I celebrate stories of extraordinary women, people who've persevered and found success on their own terms. Today, I'm in San Ynez Valley to talk to the most prominent and respected Native American female winemaker in the whole country, Tara Gomez. She makes her Quita wines with grapes grown on the land purchased by her tribe, the Band of San Ynez Valley Chumash. Tara also makes wines with her Catalan-born wife, Maria Taribo. Tara, I'm so happy you could join me on Speaking Broadly.
Thank you. Thank you for coming and being able to talk. Yeah.
I'm so excited to hear about how you came to wine, because it's not the first thing that I think of with Native American tribes people, and yet your tribe is very much a part of the winemaking that you do. How did you first fall in love with wine?
Well, actually, it was the love of science. Growing up, I had my first Fisher-Price microscope set when I was 4 years old that I actually have in our other tasting room that Mere and I both share. And from there, it grew. It was just through the love of science.
But I think there's a lot of people who like chemistry who do not end up making wine. And you went on winery tours with your parents when you were growing up. Did they have a love of wine?
They did. They loved going on weekends, going up and down the Central Coast, exploring the different tasting rooms. And yeah, we used to go on the wine tours, and just as a child, to see the large stainless steel vats. But most importantly, in one instance, I passed by the lab and I actually saw them in their white lab coats and doing titrations. And I think that was my instant connection. Which is just the sight.
They wear lab coats.
Yes. I wanted to go home and get one so I could wear it when I played around with my chemistry set.
And where were you living at the time? Were you living?
Santa Maria. So Santa Maria, California, which is about maybe 20 minutes from here. Our reservation is here in San Ynez. And we actually covered, we were coastal Indians. So from Paso Robles all the way down south to Malibu.
I read about that because there were 22,000 Chumash back in the 1700s, I think.
So from our band of Chumash, I mean, there's a lot of different tribal Chumash that do not belong to our reservation. So for our reservation, there's currently 120 voting tribal members. And I'm a descendant of my father from this tribe. So there's numerous of us descendants that are what you call the voting members of our tribe.
And does every person who is a member of the tribe get a vote?
Yes, of the 120 remaining members now, yes. And the majority of them are a lot of elders. When we purchased the property back in 2010, we had 140 members, and now we're down to, I'd say, about 120 members.
And what does that feel like, watching the numbers get smaller?
It's a little saddening, but it's the circle of life. And a lot of them, you know, as I mentioned, being our tribal elders. And so just really trying to spend as much time that we can with them and hear all the stories and learn from that so that we could carry on those traditions for the years to come.
I know that a lot of the stories were lost and the language was lost, but you're also reclaiming the language because there's a professor teaching the Samala, is that
Yes, Somala. And so, yes, we have our own dictionary. And years ago when the dictionary first came out, you know, I was taking classes myself and learning the Chumash language.
And the name of your winery, which is Kita, mm-hmm. is an oak leaf.
Yes, so Kita means our valley oak in our native Somali language, and we wanted to find that connection to the land. And it was just, there's a lot of valley oak leaves all over the vineyard. And so we felt that that was the perfect name for us. And not only that, you know, our ancestors once used to, you know, gather acorns and you used to eat that. And so, so that was an important part of the ancestors as well.
So you ended up getting a scholarship to go to enology school from the tribe.
Yes.
Was that difficult to convince them?
No. Actually, my father was on the tribal council, and he strongly believed in education. That's why, you know, he moved off the reservation, and we lived in Santa Maria, so we could get the best education we could possibly get. So yeah, with the financial support of our tribe, I was able to go off to college and get my degree and get my education. And so when I graduated, I mean, I came back and did my internship at Fess Parker, and then right upon graduation, they hired me to come back and be the enologist there. So at that time, it was like maybe about 15, 20,000 case production. So I was there for maybe about 2 years, and then I left to go up north to Paso Robles because I just wanted to move out and kind of like, you know, coming back from college, it's like I moved back home and I'm just like not used to that because I'm more independent. And so...
Was that hard? Because most people don't move away from their families, I imagine.
Yeah, you're right. Like, I never left home. And then now to leave home and to kind of learn to be a little bit independent, that took a couple of years for me. But I was really, really involved in my studies because I felt like I had to be because I had a learning disability. And it took me a little longer to get my education. And I had to study harder, but...
What was the disability that you were working with?
Just attention deficit disorder. Just I have trouble focusing and concentration. But I've always struggled with that my whole life. Trying to take exams was always challenging for me. I'd always get confused, and I was always the last person to turn in my exam because it's like it took me forever. I reread it, read it over and over again. And yeah, so as much as I love chemistry and everything, there were some instances where like, I had to repeat a class or two because you know, it was just difficult for me to comprehend.
Did you find coping mechanisms for that? Because I think that, you know, no.
I kept it all to myself, and I kept it in until, you know, it came to the point where like I almost like just like kind of like exploded in the fact that like, oh, maybe this isn't for me. And you know, I called my parents, and I was just like struggling with everything because I wasn't doing as good as I wanted to do. And that's why I kind of switched a little bit into my American Indian studies to kind of like bring me back to some sort of balance. And then I was able to, I guess, cope with it better. And my parents were just like, you know, don't do this for us. You're doing it for yourself. And so
when you went back home and you had this knowledge, mm-hmm. how did you bring what you learned back to the tribe, if you did?
Yeah, so yes, I mean, like I graduated, and when I graduated, like I said, I was at Fess Parker, and then I moved off to Jaylor, and then I was there for almost 9 years, and then that's when I left and I went to Europe for 2 years, and I worked up in the Pyrenees Mountains. And so when I came back in 2010, that was when the tribe was in negotiations with Fess Parker on purchasing the land.
I was wondering if the Camp 4 property, which was part of Fess Parker's land, and the tribe buying it was because of you, because you
no.
had worked.
The reality of it was that the tribe purchased the property to be able to build housing on the property. It's a 1,400 acre parcel of land, of in which 256 acres is dedicated to the vineyard. So for the tribe, you know, vineyard came second nature, but the main reason was to be able to build housing.
So the vineyard was a bonus.
Vineyard was a bonus. And then that's where I kind of came into play, and I was just like, okay, you know, like, we're in wine country. Like, we have a vineyard. Like, why not want to get into the wine industry? So it wasn't easy at all trying to convince the tribe.
Tell me about that.
It took a lot of really trying to prove myself to my tribe that this is the direction that we need to go, because, you know, we have the vineyard, and we're not just going to sell grapes. We need to be able to make wine off of it. So like in June, they finally agreed that, okay, like, we'll let you try it out. Pick three varietals. You can only play with 3 tons. So, like, figure it out and make some wine, and we'll taste it and we'll see. And so it was about, like, I had to prove myself.
Do you think you had less credibility because you were from the tribe?
I think a lot of that, yes, because I think they saw, in their eyes, they saw me as this little child, as this little kid.
And were you ever afraid, like, oh my goodness, I've told them I can do this.
Right, no, of course I was, because 2010 vintage, here it comes, 2010 vintage, one of the hardest vintages here in Santa Barbara County.
Is that right?
And I came into it in 2010, and so it was just like, but for me, I wasn't worried about that at all, because I just came from the Pyrenees Mountains of Spain. I've witnessed the extreme temperatures of there, and I knew exactly what I needed to do.
And so did you set up everything? I mean, you had to set up, because the grapes were planted, so you were using the grapes, but then you had...
So I came in, like, yeah, late in the season, and here I started making all these changes out in the vineyard. This is what I want done, but I was... The thing was that I was out there with the workers, working hand-in-hand with them. It's not that I was out there giving orders. I was there working with them and teaching them how I wanted my sections, you know, trained, and the work I wanted done out in the vineyard. And so I think that's where a lot of the respect came into play between me and the workers, was that, you know, I didn't want them to see me per se as their boss. I wanted to be equal with them. So yeah, I was calling, making the calls, and I just remember just being questioned a lot. Like, are you sure you want to pick? Are you sure you want to pick this early? And yeah, I knew in my gut and in my heart that this was the right time that I needed to pick.
You said that you got asked a lot of questions. Some of it, of course, was because it was first time for everybody. But do you think any of it had to do with the fact that you're a woman in this business?
Of course, yes. And I remember having this conversation with my dad, and I was like, Dad, like, they're questioning me. Like they're supposed to be working for me. Like, why are they questioning me? And my dad just said, like, well, if you feel it in your gut, like, this is what you need to do, then do it and believe in yourself. I don't get asked questions anymore. Like, are you sure you want to pick? You know, it's like, okay, Tara. After they tasted the wines, you know, they saw my style. And
well, let's talk about your style, because it seems that you have a love for Old World.
Yes.
And with some new technique, and you're so beautifully trained, both in California, but then traveling throughout Europe. Mm-hmm. So you learned, like, at the heart of wine countries where people have been making wine for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. How did you choose to go to Europe to extend your education?
Well, for me, I think it all started back when I was 16 years old, because we had a foreign exchange brother from Spain who lived with us. And when he graduated, him, my brother, myself, and my two cousins, we went to Spain. So I was only 16 years old. I can't even believe my parents let us go.
But so you guys went on your own?
We
or no
went
parents?
On our own. My first time on a plane. And yeah, we flew to Europe. We flew to Spain. It was Marbella, the south of Spain. And we stayed there with him and his family for, I think it was 2 or 3 weeks. From that point on, I really fell in love with just the culture, of you know, having wine, you know, with your meals. And it was something like, yeah, I saw my parents do that, but to see the whole family sitting there and you know, sharing, you know, the food and the wine and pairing it, and it was something really special. And so when I was at J. Lore, I remember saving, like, I wouldn't take any vacations. I would just save it all till, like, the end after harvest, and then I'd go off for like a month and just go exploring. And then that's also too how I met Mireia, was working at J. Lore, and And we had a lot of interns, and Mireya was one of the interns. And, you know, we started traveling together, and we would always plan all these trips. You know, I would go visit her, she would come visit me, and anyways, that's how our relationship grew. And, you know, just traveling together and you know, visiting all the different wineries, and she always, we go back and we talk about it, and she always says, like, you had this itinerary and we had to follow it, and we would try, I would try and cram all these wineries all into one day, and it was just like, I'm just really immersed myself into wanting to learn the history, the culture, the old world winemaking technique.
So I read that you each year pick a varietal to learn more about, and then do you produce that varietal?
Or I do. So they are varietals that I do produce. So this last one was Northern Rhone. And
good choice.
We've always wanted to go, and yeah, it was so fascinating. I love cool climate Syrahs, and that's where our second label, where our label comes into play, Caminos to Dreams, is our focus is here in Santa Rita Hills in cool climate Syrahs.
So when did you guys get married?
We got married in 2014. Have you ever seen the movie 90 Day Fiancé?
No, because that's what it was.
That's how I felt. Because here we were planning this wedding, which would be in the spring of the following year. So we went through and we did all our paperwork and everything. And we had planned that my attorneys had said that it's going to take a long time, and that just expect it in the spring of the following year. Well, she got the phone call for her interview, and that was in July, and so she had a few weeks to kind of like pack up and move.
To pack up from Barcelona,
yeah, from where she was living and working. She's a winemaker in Spain, getting ready to go right into harvest, and she had to tell her boss that, yeah, I'm leaving now. Like, she was in shock, I was in shock, and I'm like, wait, 90 days, I'm trying to count 90 days, because I'm like, I'm just about ready to start harvest, like, what do you mean you're coming? Like, I'm not ready for all of this. Like,
that must be
so it all worked out, though. I found a beautiful place out in the mountains, and a place where both of our families could stay and get to know each other, because they've never met. And so we still suffer the language barrier, though, because, you know, her family, they speak Spanish and Catalan, but mainly Catalan, because they're really strong about their Catalan language. And so, it was definitely a language barrier. But
and what about cultural? Because you have, you know, Spanish and Native American. What was that like?
Well, it is kind of interesting, because, yeah, I ended up falling in love with someone from another country, let alone from Spain. But sometimes you just can't help who you fall in love with, and it happens. And so my parents didn't see it like that at all, though, that, you know, see it as a flaw for her being Spanish or anything like that. You know, they're there to support me and for the love that I have towards Mireya. And so, you know, they were my support group.
So the intersection of the culture and the winemaking, part of this notion of balance, but also respect for nature and not too much intervention. I'd love to hear the ways in which the philosophy that you grew up with has influenced the winemaking that you do.
Well, I mean, for me, like, yeah, balance is everything. Finding, you know, being in balance, you know, with yourself and your surroundings, and in winemaking, it's kind of like the same thing. Finding that balance between, you know, the alcohol, the acidity, the structure, the flavor of the wines. And in grape growing, you know, it's the soil, it's the climate. It's the geographical region, you know, trying to find that balance.
Does the tribe have any influence on the wine that you make?
I think I'm teaching them a lot, and so from that, they'll tell me, like, yes, I like it like this, or, you know, but a lot of that is through me teaching them. And so also to, you know, they like to hear from the consumers as well, and what the consumers have to say about it, because that is the end product, is the consumer. And if they're happy, if the consumers are happy, they're happy. The tribe is happy.
So. I know that the tribe has a casino. Do they sell the wine at the casino?
They do, yes.
They do?
Yes.
So in terms of distribution, does...
We do sell the wine to the casino, but one thing you have to understand is that even though we're an enterprise within an enterprise, meaning that we're under the same umbrella, we're all treated differently. So we all have our own budgets that we have to follow and everything. So I'm treated just like anybody else on the outside. Maybe I get a little bit of leeway in, but yeah, not much.
Why is that? That seems like they would love your wine.
Well, they do love the wine, but I'm still working on that.
Because it would be such a great way to, I mean, they could probably take all your 2,000 cases.
Yes. Sometimes, though, the easiest things... are the hardest.
And that would be one of them.
Yeah, somewhat.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Welcome back. This is Dana Cowan, and you are listening to Speaking Broadly, specially recorded in Santa Ynez Valley in California. Today I'm talking to Tara Gomez, who's an extraordinary winemaker, and we're going to talk a little bit about some of the wines that you make under the Quita label. People love the Grenache Rosé.
I think that's like our number one seller. I don't know if it's just like a rosé kick that everybody's... It's like a varietal that you could drink like year-round, a wine that you could drink year-round. And so, our Grenache Rosé is made specifically for the Rosé program, meaning that we pick specifically for the Rosé.
And you pair it with some surprising things. What are some of those things?
What's so interesting about Rosé, though, is that there's so many options to pair with it. I mean, you could even pair it with steaks, or you could pair it with salads, or you could pair it with fish. And at least with our rosé, because it's just so fresh, it's bright, it has some really nice acidity, and it just makes it like an easy wine to be able to pair with any sort of dish.
But I think you paired up with donuts.
So we paired it with donuts, we paired it with popcorn. So yeah.
Is that to prove the point that you can actually pair it with almost anything?
Right. Well, we just, our tasting room manager, Brittany, I love having her on the team because she gets really creative in terms of creating these food and wine pairings and comes up with these really cool and different ideas. And I'm just like, donuts? Like, I'm not really sure, but there's this donut company in Buellton that we actually worked with. So we had a tasting with them, and then they created specific donuts that paired with our wine. Yeah.
And how do you make that happen? Because it seems like, I guess you make it not too sugary, right? What's,
yeah.
what's the name
well,
of the...
Well, the sugar and just the flavor profiles that they add into the donuts, the toppings, they get really creative with that. And it went really well. And we had a lot of people that came and really enjoyed... having the donut and wine pairing, and they're asking for it again. So
has having the tasting room made a huge difference in sales and people understanding
your
story?
Yes, absolutely, because then you're able to tell the story. I mean, like, we weren't open to the public before, so we didn't have that DTC side of it, direct to consumer, so we were selling wholesale, and so we weren't really able to benefit as much and to be able just to share the wine and tell the story. And I think that's what's so important, because there's so much to be told.
Were there any Native Americans you could look up to and say, that's me?
As a winemaker, there were no other Native American winemakers that I could talk to. I don't know. To this day, I don't know if there's any out there yet. I mean, I know that there are tribes that got into the wine industry, but they brought on consultants from Napa to make the wine for them. And I think that's what separates our tribe from the rest of the tribes, is that we have one from within our own tribe.
And was that hard? Just like, there's no one who looks like me, who comes from my background, who's doing this. Like, did that stop you in your tracks at all?
No, I think it actually made me want to work that much harder. It did the opposite, because just growing up a minority all through life, I've dealt with that. And so it was nothing new. And once some of the consumers connect me to the tribe, I get a lot of negativity. And so that it's not what's in the bottle, it's what I'm connected to. And once they realize that I'm from the tribe, or that I'm an enterprise of the tribe, they don't want anything to do with me.
Why is that? That surprises me.
I just think that it's always been there, at least for our tribe. Here in the community, there are some supporters, but there are a lot of people that don't support us. And so it's just, growing up, it's something that we were always faced with. And so, does it surprise me? No. But at least being here in Lompoc, I'm able to express myself, and I'm able to have them taste the wine and let them see for themselves without the prejudgment, because not everybody knows that, you know, until we tell the story that, yeah, we're from the tribe and this, and, you know.
And what did that feel like growing up, feeling like people had these negative impressions of you before you actually opened your mouth?
At first, yeah, it was hurtful, and it took some time. I mean, I went to a private school, and there wasn't many minorities there. And so, you know, I was always faced with that, but it didn't stop me at all. I mean, it made me persevere and continue to move forward. Like, I don't frown on that. It's their loss, not mine. For the way they feel. I don't let it get to me. It's I don't need that negativity. And I just do me and continue to, you know, just share the story.
But it is interesting to make the choice to share the story, because some people...
Well, they don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear it. I'm not going to be rude back to them. I'm just, thank you for your time, you know, and hopefully one day you can taste the wine, because it's actually really good or something, you know. You know, it doesn't put me, you know, two negativities don't make a right. So,
right.
So I just need to be positive in that sense. That's how I move forward. That's how I find my balance as well. It's just like, I don't need to bring on any of that and frown on that, because that's not going to get me anywhere. I'm not going to change their mind. If they,
although you might one bottle at a time.
Yeah, there you go. That's what I'm saying. It's what's in the bottle. Just taste the wine.
On each episode of Speaking Broadly, I ask my guest to give a shout out broadly to a woman they admire who they want more people to know about. Who would you like to give a shout out broadly to?
So there's Timmeri Loray, who used to work with me, and I used to mentor her. She graduated from college, and then I took her under my wings and brought her in. And a couple years ago, she left Kita and moved on to Folded Hills. She's growing and she's learning, and she's the general manager of Folded Hills. So I'm so proud of seeing her grow and blossom. She's really dedicated into everything that she does, and everything she puts her mind to, she accomplishes. So it's so great to see.
I'm always interested in finding a product that is better than the hype.
I would have to say I'm a Yeti girl, in the sense that I love the water bottles. I think I have every single type and size of bottles that they offer, and the backpack and the ice chests. And when I go fishing,
I'm sitting here looking at Akita Wines Yeti bottle. I mean, you really, it is your truth. You're surrounded everywhere by Yetis.
My coffee mugs, wine glass, or wine holders. They're they're Yeti.
Well, with that, thank you so much, Tara, for joining me on Speaking Broadly. I loved hearing your story. And thank all of you listeners for listening. If you like what you hear, please rate and review us and listen to more podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you like to listen. And if you have suggestions or recommendations, I'd love to hear from you. I'm also open to happy criticism, but please send along your thoughts and ideas and have a really great week.
Speaking Broadly is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. And you can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without the support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.